She will be joined by Peter Doshi, Assistant Professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and Associate Editor for the BMJ, John Girardini, Clinical Professor in Critical and Ethical Mental Health Research Group at the University of Adelaide, John Nardo, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry for Emory University, and David Healy, Professor of Psychiatry for Bangor University. And with that, Dr. Godley, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for joining. I'll make some very brief introductory remarks. The story behind this study is well known, I think, to people who've taken an interest in it. 2001, when the study was first published, concluding that the drug was safe and effective in adolescents, and the subsequent building of concern about the study, with eventual pressure on the journal itself to retract the institution to act against the authors, and the regulatory system to try to bring pressure to bear on the company. What we now have as a result of an enormous amount of work on the part of this research team and the BMJ's editors and some additional independent review, with cooperation, it has to be said, by the manufacturer GSK to make the data available, is an opportunity to set the record straight. The authors of the original study did not choose to take part in this exercise, and as a result of an initiative that Peter Doshi, who you'll hear from in a moment, initiated within the BMJ, the Restoring Invisible and Abandoned Trials Initiative, we are very proud to be publishing this particular piece of work, setting the record straight on this individual drug in this group of patients, but also proud because of what it tells us about the state of the evidence base, what it tells us about how drugs are evaluated and regulated at the moment, and helps us to think about what needs to change to improve the reliability of the evidence base in terms of transparency and the independence of the research that leads to changes in patient care. So with that brief introductory statement, I will pass on to, I think it's Peter Doshi.
Hi, Fee, thank you. Let me just perhaps back up and tell you a little bit about RIOT. RIOT stands for Restoring Invisible and Abandoned Trials, and is fundamentally about correcting the scientific record. And it addresses two major problems with the scientific record. One is that there are many clinical trials that go unpublished. The other sort of twin parallel problem is that trials that do get published aren't always published accurately. And so what we have is a scientific record that has holes and misrepresentations. The publications, in this case, we had a publication that was misleading. So there's a need to correct the record, but that doesn't always happen. And so what RIOT says, the whole RIOT initiative is based on the premise that if the responsible parties won't do what's right, then others will. So what we have here before you, for those who have been following the story now for about 15 years, is one paper in 2001 saying that paroxetine is safe and effective. Essentially, that's what the paper says. And a new analysis that we're publishing this week, a RIOT reanalysis, which says the drug is unsafe and ineffective. So starkly different conclusions here. Now, I think the RIOT authors have it right, but you don't have to take it on trust anymore. That's what's so new about this. Now the data are available. The research article that we're publishing is, in my view, an article of the future. It's a model for the future of publishing. You're getting a 10-page summary, a journal article, as you always did with a clinical trial. But now the summary comes with the data. The data are there for anybody to go and do their own homework. You don't have to take it on trust anymore. Now, what would have happened if that data were available 15 years ago when this study was originally published? Would we have had all the illegal off-label marketing? Would we have had the $3 billion Glaxo settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice? Would over 2 million off-label prescriptions to kids in the United States have occurred? Would the black box warnings that we saw from the FDA, would they have come earlier in time? Those are questions I posed to you about the importance of publishing studies with the data, and that's what's happening today for the first time with this study. So perhaps I'll leave it there. I wanted to leave the conclusions of the study for the to present.
Thank you, Peter. Shall I come in there? It's John Jardine speaking. I think one thing that's important to remind people about is that although Study 329 is somewhat infamous, it was plausible when it came out, and there's probably only a dozen people around the world who spotted the problem with this paper in its published form. So I'd urge you, when you're looking at this analysis, not to think that this is a rogue study that's been picked out. It's not necessarily different from a whole range of other studies that that are published in medicine. And we came into this study really expecting to find that paroxetine wouldn't demonstrate an efficacy advantage over placebo, and that's indeed what we found when we properly followed the protocol. What we're a bit more surprised to find was the degree to which the harms data had been interfered with in the process of preparing the Keller paper that was published in 2001. And you'll see from our paper that the harms associated with this drug in this trial were quite striking. Twice the severe adverse events, four times the psychiatric events, and high levels of suicide and self-harm, all of which was unclear in the previous publication. One thing that was unexpected in our analysis was to be able to identify important potential barriers to the accurate reporting of harms. And I refer you to page 13 and 14 of our paper, where we list 10 ways in which harms can be underreported in reports of randomized controlled trials, all of which are relevant to were in effect in this paper, and we'd have to assume are widespread throughout the publishing world. And the final point that we learnt from our hard work is that if you are going to check on the research integrity the integrity of a particular piece of research, then you have to absolutely have access to two things. The original protocol that was supposed to have guided the research and its analysis, and individual patient-level data. Without the former, you can't be confident about the integrity of the efficacy results that are reported, and without the latter, you can have no confidence in the way that harms are reported. As Dr. Godley says, we did have a level of cooperation from the sponsor of this study in terms of providing data, but it's also notable that that data was provided in a way which was extremely difficult to navigate, extremely time-consuming, and really exaggerated the difficulties required with doing this kind of analysis. And I think one of the things that we'd want to say is that it is and will be increasingly possible for other people to do this kind of analysis of studies without having to go through the torture that we have to go through in order to do it, partly learning from our experience in terms of methodology, but also hopefully in a more enlightened future being given reasonable access to data in a way that it would enable its much more rapid analysis. So at that point, I'm not sure whether Mickey or David want to add anything, or whether we move straight to questions.
I think we should move possibly straight on to the questions. That'll be my proposal.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Great. As a quick reminder, we're going to cycle through questions in the order in which you joined the call. Did anyone else join in after we had begun?
Yes, I did. Bob Siderman, freelance journalist and author of the Surapchat scandal.
Great. All right, so with that then, we'll go to Denise Rowland.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I wondered if you could talk me through a bit more the process of getting this data. So what was already out there and what have you unearthed and what did it take to do that? Did it have to come from the company or were there other ways of getting hold of this evidence and how long did it take you?
The clinical study report, the CSR, or part of it, the body of it, had been made available publicly after the litigation involving the New York Attorney General. The further litigation, I think, involved the publishing of the appendices of the CSR. But that still didn't provide individual patient data. In order to get that was a long process of negotiation with GSK, and that took many months. And then when the data was made available, as I've said, and others could probably speak with more authority about this, enormous difficulties in accessing the data to the point where we could only see a third of the clinical record forms just simply because it was such a slow process that we didn't have time to review all of them. Mm-hmm. And so that has proved to them. I mean, if we were costing that process out in dollar terms, it would have been an enormously expensive process. It needn't have been. And I think an important thing to note is that none of that data would have been available in the first place if it hadn't have been for litigation or similar actions. It may at times have been presented as an enlightened act by GSK, but those who are in the know could explain to you that this is reactive to litigation.
Yeah. Yeah.
David and Mickey, I've probably left some stuff out. Did you want to clarify anything that I said?
No, I think that's fine, John.
Okay. We'll go to
I might just add a little something. That 2004 is when the suit was in New York. They only posted the narrative part, and the real data was in the appendices, and they weren't really made available till 2012 when somebody finally realized that the whole story hadn't been told and reactivated the old New York suit.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, next we'll go to Christina Fiore.
Hi, so can you explain a little bit more, maybe give us an example of how the protocol shifted from, you know, when it was initially set out to how it changed in the study?
Yeah, that is probably, it's set out in quite a bit of detail in the paper that Lehman McHenry and Peter Mansfield and I published in, I think it was 2011. But essentially, the initial protocol set out two primary outcomes and six secondary outcomes. The reported paper misleadingly conflated one of those primary outcomes with a non-protocol specified outcome and introduced several more non-protocol specified outcomes. And so basically probably only one of the eight initial outcomes survived, protocol-specified outcomes survived intact through to the published paper.
Thanks very much.
Okay. I might go to, I can add something to that, and that is that the four variables that were reported in the published paper as significant were all add-ins. They all came after the fact.
Got it. Thanks.
Sarah Bosley's next.
Hi. I think it was John. Forgive me if I got your name wrong. You were talking about the adverse reaction data, and I think the word you used was that the harm data was interfered with. Could you actually tell me what you mean by that? And are you saying that the company, or in fact the investigators, deliberately did not report harm that happened to some of the subjects?
Well, in the sample of those, the third that we were able to look at the CRFs, the clinical record forms, there was about a 15% rate of non-transcription of adverse events from those record forms through to the database. And so that was one problem. We can't say whether that was deliberate or accidental. The next problem was the coding of those adverse events. And here it's hard to think that there wasn't some mischief being done when a severe suicide attempt requiring hospitalisation was coded as emotional lability. There were several other what looked to the impartial observer to have been deliberate attempts to play down the adverse event profile. We can't be definite about that, but that's what it kind of looks like, including crowding out psychiatric adverse events by grouping them in with very common events like headache and dizziness, which you would expect to be highly frequent in both the placebo and the drug group. And then on top of that, there was the further distortion in the transition between what had been documented in the CSR and what went into the final Keller paper. So there were those four levels of refinement, if you like, of the adverse event profile, all of which were potentially favourable to paroxetine on the way through, some of which seemed unlikely to be accidental.
Did you put that to anybody, either to Keller or to the company, that there had been actually some manipulation of the data there?
Well, on that front, perhaps I can hop in here. We did get in touch with GSK and say that we had been finding that there was what appeared to be transcription errors in the material that they'd made available to us in the first instance. And in order to audit that we actually needed access to the individual patient level data. So they were very aware from early on that we were actually finding a mismatch between what they had offered and what appeared to be the case. The other thing is that GSK have had a draft of this paper from last March and haven't got back to us at any point to say that anything we've done is in any way wrong. Now, they may get back to us during the course of the next week or two, but up till this, they haven't.
Great. We'll go to Kate Kelland.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. I'm just trying to nail down what you found in this specific publication that's coming this week that is new about the effect of either the efficacy or the adverse events linked to this drug. So because you've said, and we know what, that the black label warnings were put onto this drug in 2008-2009. The link with suicide was revealed then. Is it the what have you found that is new about the effect or the side effects of the drug in this paper?
We've not found anything new in terms of the effectiveness of the drug because, we've not found anything surprising about the effectiveness of the drug. We now know in a way that we didn't know before that the drug is ineffective or was ineffective in the study. In terms of the harms, the difference is quite striking, really, between what we found and what we knew before we carried out this exercise.
Right.
And
so we knew that it was harmful and had an increased risk of suicide associated with it or suicidal ideation, but we didn't know the extent.
Kate,
is that right?
Could I add in here? Two things here. First of all, in terms of the way children are being treated, the guidelines that are out there at the moment still resort to and refer to and build on the Keller paper, which says this drug works. GSK, in the course of the last year, have said they are very happy with the Keller paper that's out there. They believe it to be a reasonable representation of the data. So this is the first time you're going to have two different articles saying very different things. I mean, John refers to the fact that we knew that a small group of us knew that the drug didn't work all that well, but actually the wider world still thinks this drug works quite well and it's built into the guidelines. The other aspect to it is the degree of harms. In the Keller paper, there were 5 children became suicidal. GSK, when they were under FDA scrutiny, said, well, we agree that was wrong. There were 9. FDA said, well, we think even that's probably wrong. We think there were 10. And what we found is that there was at least 12. And the point about the figure of 12 is that we think that if you were to go in and look at the data, that anyone, even without any training at all, would find that there's something of the order of at least 12 instances of children becoming suicidal on this drug out of only approximately 93 children. So this is a very, very high rate. So the point here is that...
I lost you on that last number. At least 12 out of only 93.
3 children, yeah. So this is a very high rate of kids going on to become suicidal. And it doesn't take expertise to find these. It really takes extraordinary expertise to avoid being able to find them.
Okay.
Then we'll go to Kat Lay.
No questions, thanks.
Okay.
Can I just add in quickly before the next question? On that last question, I just want to add in and reinforce this idea that, again, what we're moving from now is a model where it's the author's word versus the previous author's word, and one has to judge based on the authority of those authors. So I trust the Brown University professors, they're distinguished people in their field, and that's the end of the story, versus I trust the authors, John Gherardini, David Healy, Mickey Nardo, and colleagues. We don't have to do that anymore. We're in a state where the data are now available for other people to vet. That's what's new here. That's it.
Okay.
Next is Ariana Cha.
The one thing I'm confused about is, I guess there have been questions raised about this drug and its use in children for quite a while. Where were all the regulators in this? What is their role? Didn't they have access to the raw data? Why wouldn't they be doing the same analysis that it took you so long to get access to the data to do?
That's a good question, and let me leap in here and say that, in fact, what FDA, broadly speaking, do is they audit the data. They don't, in the ordinary course of events, actually have access to the raw data other than notionally. They certainly don't go through it. And that's part of the reason why the data needs to be made fully and widely available, so that other people who are who have an interest to go through the data can do so.
And if I can add on to that point, because I think it's a very good question, there are many cases, and this is one of them, where regulators have already made a judgment that is very contrary to what may be there, out there in the mainstream among professionals and their societies. And this, what we have here is another case where regulators are completely ineffective in actually influencing what people understand about the trials that they have scrutinized very carefully. It's not that they scrutinize every trial equally carefully, but in some cases they scrutinize trials very well, and they make that clear in their notes that do become public via Freedom of Information Act, but otherwise not consumed. So there's no FDA letter to the editor published saying, be careful about the analysis that was published in this journal many years ago. FDA has reviewed the data and come to very different conclusions. They're not engaged at that level, and that's a big problem.
Can I just add that, you know, with in response to the comment, a couple of comments about, you know, didn't we already know this about this study? In a sense, the work that we've undertaken is not really about study 329. It's about data access. And what difference does it make to have access to the data? And, you know, Mickey's point right at the beginning about what difference, or maybe it was Peter's, about what difference it would have made if this was the routine process that was carried out right at the point of publication, rather than something that people have had to battle for 15 years to bring into the public domain. So really the awfulness of the Keller paper is a really of secondary importance. What's the message we really want to get across is that there's no research integrity without this level of data access.
Yeah, I might just, can I add something to that? And that is that when we say the word data, that can get really confusing, and we try to clear that up in the paper, but there's the clinical study report, which is a narrative, which may or may not have the data in it. The IPD and the clinical report form, the CRF, those are the actual data numbers and the data reports that come from the study. So there's a lot of noise about releasing the clinical study report, but in a lot of cases, that's just another version of what the company had to say about the drug. It's just longer than the paper.
So if I could jump in here, it's Christina Pierre with MedPage Today. What is Riot doing to encourage companies to give up not only the CSRs but all of the individual patient level data? And are you building a platform where researchers could go to work with that data?
So just to clarify, Riot is it's not a group nor a party. It is a concept. And what you're seeing today in this publication is part of the evolution of that concept. Riot exists when data transparency occurs or exists. Without data transparency, Riot is merely an idea that has no legs. It is only because of access to data that we can correct the record, that we can say that the publications of the past were misleading and need to be corrected. So in that sense, it's important not to see Riot as a group or a party speaking, a block of people, but it's a concept that anybody, it's a baton that anybody can pick up and run with, and hear what you're saying is the authors have done that.
Yeah, and the answer to her question is, what are we doing to promote this? We're publishing this paper.
Can I just come in, Jenna Godley here, just to pick up on the wider implications of this particular work? I think it is a part of the peace movement towards much greater transparency. The All Trials campaign, campaign, that all trials should be registered and all results reported, and that without that level of transparency moving forward into the availability of the actual patient data for legitimate independent third-party scrutiny. Those are the things that we're all, those of us pushing for this are trying to see happen. I think I would like to add, from my own point of view, and others who would say the same, that the other piece of this is the other side of the coin, which is the level of independence of the original research. And to my mind, we can't really have one without the other, that we need both greater transparency, and this study shows why. And we also need, I think, a much greater push for independent research. The manufacturers of all drugs have an irreducible conflict of interest, and I think we need to look for new ways to fund research, possibly through contributions from manufacturers into more of an independent central pot, whether globally or in each country, because I think this episode also shows how difficult it is for manufacturers of drugs to give an independent view, or even if they are giving an independent view, to be trusted to give that independent view by those who are having to consume the results of the studies. This is very much an evolving picture, and I think it is fair to say that GSK, of all the pharmaceutical companies, have led the moves towards transparency. So it's rather ironic, if you like, that this particular very infamous study should be a GSK study, but there's a huge amount still to do to achieve the holy grail of proper transparency and independence of research.
So I think we have time for one more question and one more to get to.
Yes. May I ask the question, Bob Fiddleman?
Have
GlaxoSmithKline or any of the original study authors been approached the final reanalysis results, and if so, what was their response?
Bob, they were...
All of the authors were approached about earlier concerns raised about the paper, the Keller paper, but we haven't yet approached the authors with our most recent study findings.
And
GSK?
GSK have... GSK have actually had this paper since March.
And no response at all from them?
Not to us that we're aware of.
Okay, thank you.
And what about the...
Peter, perhaps you could just contribute a thing about how Riot works and how we approach authors before making a paper Riotable.
Sure. So the process of writing, it's meant to be a transparent process that only occurs when there's legitimate reason for it. And so in the case of this paper, they followed that method to a T. And what that consisted of was, first, publishing in the BMJ a rapid response that said, the original 2001 publication is problematic and in need of correction. The parties have so far not done that, and we will plan to do this unless we hear from the responsible parties, the company and the authors, telling us that they are going to do this themselves. And so they give them a period of time for the authors to do it themselves. That did not occur. And the Riot team, led by John Girardini, went ahead and conducted this process. GSK is clearly aware of the process. They have mentioned this use of the data for reanalysis in presentations they've given, and that so they're very well aware of it. But we have not heard from them a response to the paper, as the authors explained.
And how about this journal that published the original paper? Are they aware of this paper that's coming out? Have they made any, I think the editorial that goes along called for a retraction, have they made any indication that they might retract it?
So the
The feature article that I've written and will be published alongside the research study and the editorial really goes into depth at asking the many parties that have responsibility here for a response. And so I went to Martin Keller. I went to his university, Brown University. I went to the editor-in-chief, Andres Martin, of the journal that published this in 2001. I went to the academy, whose journal it was published in. The editor-in-chief did not return my many requests for comment. I wasn't able to speak with the academy either, despite many requests. Brown University would not confirm nor deny whether it had even done an investigation into this study. Martin Keller, the first author of that paper, also didn't respond to my requests. And so my feature really is about this no correction, no retraction, no apology, and no comment position, the incredible resistance of these many parties to actually take responsibility for it. And I quote Ivan Oransky of RetractionWatch.org in my piece, who says that, you know, the editor-in-chief of the journal that published this has said that they've looked into it and are satisfied with it, and there's no need for retraction. He says, well, okay, well, fine, then make your internal inquiry public. Tell us why you came to such drastically different conclusions about this paper than the U.S. Department of Justice, for example. Tell us why, and that hasn't occurred.
Do any of you envisage any sort of law enforcement to become involved in all of these?
Bob, I'll give you an initial response to that. The issue about research misconduct and whether it could at any point be considered to be a criminal offence is, I think, a very interesting one. And whenever I've raised this, the view has been that this is complicated and financial misconduct is difficult enough. Research misconduct is a whole another ball game. But I think there are movements, and this is a debate ongoing about the extent to which research misconduct, which I think we can all agree seems to have happened here, and certainly in many other instances, could be subject to criminal proceedings. But to my knowledge, that happens only where there is a clear financial mismanagement. Others of you may have some more information on that, but it is, in my view, an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Could I ask a quick question?
Now, in the interest of time, I think we'll go to Dr. Godley with some closing remarks.
Thank you very much indeed. I don't have a great deal more to say. I think I'm very, very pleased that you've all shown an interest in this study when we were discussing whether to publish it and whether we should, whether there would be press interest in it. There was a sort of sense in the study which has been so dissected and discussed over the years that what was there new to say. I've been very convinced from the outset that this study represented not only a very, this reanalysis, not only a very important, as I said, setting the record straight, but also something iconic in terms of the references to the legislation, the regulation and evaluation of common drugs. And I think it's really our responsibility in the medical journals world and the academic world and also in the media to try to make the case for greater transparency and greater independence in research.
Thank you, everyone, for joining.
Have
a nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. There you go. Oh, no problem. No problem.
You know when you kind of stop it as well,
yeah,
it's worth it.
Okay.
That was interesting.
So you can have all of that.